to hold your 3-3.
Okay, well, Bob Meister we're talking about, and so we came down to the bottom of the hill. And at the bottom we turned left, which was west, around the base of our mountain feature, where a few Chinese remnants, hangers on or chaps had fallen by the wayside, and we shot them, and marched our way across the plain, because between our particular mountain feature, or the Gloucester Hill, and the Imjin, there was a fairly flat bit down to the river. And we marched across these paddy fields for about a mile, and then turned south down this valley, which my car we found on the map. Right. Anyhow, we turned left down this valley, and there was a small stream running along the side of the feature. Right, and so the whole company started going down this path, and on the right of us was a little river. Couldn't have been more than about 3 feet deep. And as we turned into the valley, after about 200 or 300 yards, suddenly machine gun fire came in from our right, which is from the west side. So in other words, we were moving down the left-hand side of the valley, which was the east side of it, but from the hills on the right, the Chinese positions obviously were there, and then machine guns down as we trooped down this valley. Few people were hit, I suppose. I don't know whether anybody was actually hit at that time, but we jumped into this small stream or river and used it as some sort of cover. Well, we thought we were doing all right until suddenly there were a series of tremendous explosions ahead of us, and you could see the odd bodies flying through the air. And we looked further and we saw that there were American tanks advancing up the valley towards us. These tanks have got tigers painted on the front of them. I suppose the American tank battalion commanders had thought that the tigers would have terrified the Chinese. Certainly terrified us, because they thought that we were a Chinese force coming down the river and we were trying to attack them. So their gunfire into the ditch obviously did a lot of damage. I don't know how many people they killed. But over our head was a little aircraft. I think it was known as a Harvard, and it's an American spotter plane. And they had realized that we were British coming out of the Imjin feature area, and they were attempting to either strafe the Chinese positions on the hills that were shooting down at us, or something. Anyhow, it appeared to me, anyhow, that the aircraft had signaled in some way to these American tanks to stop firing. Whether it was that, but whether or not it was my white handkerchief that had been handed down the line from me up to my car, we had asked for some, and waved to the American tanks to show that we were surrendering to them, I don't know. But anyhow, after time, this tank firing stopped, and we carried on. Now, by this stage, we were all pretty well split up. We were going down this river, we were crossing the fields, and then appeared in front of us a South Korean battalion of troops who had obviously been sent up this valley with the American tanks to do some form of counterattack, as far as I know. And at this stage, I landed up in the arms of these Korean soldiers, who then took me and some other people off south, trying to feed us, I remember, with dry biscuits that got stuck in our throats because we hadn't had anything to drink properly for 2 or 3 days, apart from water out of the river. And other people apparently ended up in the lee of the American tanks, and as a result were protected from the fire from the Chinese from them, and they brought them down and out. And I remember walking along with these rock soldiers. Yeah, they call them Republic of Korean soldiers, and meeting up with some American tanks who turned around and we got on them, and we were ferried back to a marshalling area which was picking up what was left of the battalion. So that, to me, was the end of the Imjin battle. And after that, we were formed up into some sort of group and sent off south, and the battalion was reformed, and I was given a new platoon, and I think they were mostly men from the Royal Fusiliers, which had sent out reinforcements.
Could I just stop you there and ask you some questions? In what condition were you when you got out?
I was unwounded. A lot of my men were unwounded, and we got 17 soldiers out of my platoon out. I was tired, and hungry, but not too much so. I had felt, I'd looked on it, subconsciously that is, as a young chap, who'd been taking part in some sort of exciting game, and the full force of what had happened to the battalion or to the whole of the sort of United Nations line didn't mean really too much to me. All I knew was that I was with my platoon and that most of us had managed to get out, and I had no idea that the rest of the battalion were either captured or killed. And so what had actually happened was that whereas Mike Harvey and us have gone back this other way, and some of us managed to get out, the rest of the battalion had gone back the conventional way, i.e. straight down this main road from Gloucester Crossing, and as a result had all been picked up and captured and whatever happened to them by the Chinese on the way out. So we were quite lucky, really.
What kind of conversation was going on amongst the men of your group
I mean, they were all sort of pretty well inured to battle because they'd been through it in the Second World War, presumably. And they all seemed to take it in a fairly phlegmatic sort of way. Now, I don't remember any particular incident in which any of the soldiers around me collapsed with fear or despondency. All they were thinking of was, what the hell's going to happen, and when are we going to get out of this? And of course they were quite happy in a way that they were not going to be. I mean, I think some of them may have even been prisoners of war in the Second World War, and the last thing they want to do is to be taken captured again for another period. And so they were very relieved when they got out. And from then on, because they were reservists, they were all taken away from me. I think they probably felt that these chaps had had enough.
We hear something nowadays quite often about the need of people who've been in battle for counselling. What's your opinion of that, in view of your own experience?
Well, there wasn't any counselling in those days, obviously. As far as I know, I mean, if you took me as an example, I got back, I was clapped on my back, I said, well done, you got out, now we're going to give you a new platoon, and your job is to go to the banks of the Han River near Seoul and guard the bridges there. And so we went back, Dennis Watmore and I, that was all that were left really, platoon commanders, because the other platoon commander, Tom Keneally, got shot apparently and was captured. Bob Martin, the machine gun officer, came out with us. He was, I think, made adjutant for a time. I'm not sure. I can't remember what happened to him. Or intelligence officer of the battalion. And us two chaps were the only ones left in the whole battalion of officers. Oh, some platoon commanders, anyhow. Yeah. The early two, isn't it? And so D Company was reconstituted with new soldiers. And how did we feel? Well, that's right. Dennis told me that he'd had a few nightmares after it. And I didn't have any nightmares, and I never had any since, or anything like that. And I think it's because the excitement of it was very high. It was exciting all the time. One didn't know what the hell was going to happen next. There was a fear of death, yes, but I was a good Catholic lad in those days and done my praying. So I felt that all that was all right on that side of it. And because I was a platoon commander in charge of people, it gave me this sort of subconscious sense of duty that there was me in charge of them. There's no fear. I can't show any fear. I can't feel. I'm in charge. I can't be frightened or anything like that. And so, come on, let's go. And it was a sort of, I think it was a sense of being in charge, and rather like a woman is in charge of her children, and she thinks of nothing but saving her children. A young officer has this feeling of saving his men and that sort of thing. And that buoyed me up and took me through, and I never felt any sort of serious after result. Whether or not any of the men, but I mean, I think the whole ethos of the army may have been slightly different. I mean, you were there to fight, and you'd heard all about the Second World War. You knew that thousands of people had suffered, thousands of people had been killed. It was an everyday event. It wasn't long after the Second World War, and that's what was expected of you. And if you got killed or wounded, it was one of the sort of problems that you had to accept. And I think that was the general attitude then.
What had been your opinion of the Chinese army after having been in close contact with them?
Well, we'd heard rumours that they were soldiers who had been gathered up together and just pushed ahead by their officers. Yeah, so the Chinese soldiers were forced ahead in battle, and a number of them didn't appear to have weapons, and in fact I saw two or three soldiers who leapt up on my position at the first day of the battle, certainly had no weapons with them, and all they were interested in was jumping into our trenches and finding food in them. As a result, they lost their lives, poor chap.
How do you know they were looking for food?
Well, they were picking tins up and looking at them. I was eating little bits out of them. Whether or not they were looking, but they looked as though they were anyhow. They were all over the place, and they were being organized and commanded through bugle calls and whistles. And we used to hear the odd bugle call and whistle around us. And I know in particular because when I was down by the river on the first night and trying to get back to my position, I had a whistle and I thought by blowing it somebody might have heard and they were shut and it might have had some effect on the gunfire, because it didn't. And the soldier said, for God's sake, sir, don't blow your whistle. The Chinese blow whistles. They think we're Chinese. So they used to use whistles to organize themselves. What else about the Chinese? They didn't have much artillery, obviously, because, in fact, they didn't seem to have any, because none of our positions, as far as I know, were attacked by gunfire. There was no stage in which shells landed from Chinese on our positions. The only weapons that seemed to arrive were machine gun bullets. Some people said they were explosive machine gun bullets, but I don't think they were probably. The noise of explosions was probably the bullets hitting the rock. So there were no high explosives, sort of, and we didn't feel effective in our position of any mortars firing on us or anything like that. So that didn't seem to be the only action on the part of the Chinese soldiers that I remember during that battle was small arms fire.
How determined did they seem to be in pressing their attacks?
Pretty determined. Oh yes, they came in as hard as they could and only stopped when they were forced by gunfire to go back. And don't forget, they had a fair amount of artillery strapping on them too. But obviously they were forceful enough, they knocked off the various companies in our battalion off the hilltops, certainly on the second night, and they, in the first night, they stormed up the side of A Company and pushed them off the hill.
What impression did you get of their numbers?
Just a lot. There were a lot of them around. But it's awfully difficult to separate folklore from fact. I mean, we knew there were a lot of Chinese about, but we'd also heard that they come up and they attack in hordes. And it was the impression that they attacked our hill in hordes, rather like buffaloes, and that they were separated and moved to either side of it when they were stopped.
What did they look like close up?
They wore a sort of dun-coloured, light sandy uniform.
Were they warmly clad?
They looked it looked fairly thin clothes to me. Yeah, I don't think they were particularly warmly clad. But at that stage it was April, and the weather was warm. It was quite hot. So they wouldn't have been wearing cold weather clothing. No.
Did they have any equipment on their bodies which was of any use to you?
How do you mean? I mean, we didn't get a chance of getting at their bodies. They got up. I mean, the only soldiers we saw were those attacking. Never saw, didn't come across any other soldiers. I mean, by that stage, we'd been pushed back. So I never came across any soldiers.
Were they shouting and screaming as they charged?
In my particular case, I don't recall hearing them shouting and screaming, although I think I heard the odd cry, but nothing particular. Dennis Watmore would have had a much better impression of this, because he was in the forefront, and he actually had them actually marching up towards him. By the time that I had them coming, they were coming up the sides and not straight towards me.
Now, afterwards, you said you were given this new unit and new duty, if you could take it.
Same duty, the same platoon, 12 platoon, but new chaps, new soldiers, that's right.
What happened to you then?
We, all we did was we guarded bridges on the Han River, and after that, we went back into the line on a different hill. Not far away from where we'd actually fought that battle. This was Hill 414, which must have been about a mile and a half behind, or in other words, south, of Gloucester Hill. And we spent a lot of time on top of that hill, building up defensive positions, for about, after I would say about August or so, 1951, Then after that, the whole of the United Nations line crossed the Imjin River, and the battalion went with them, and we took up new positions on the north of the Imjin River, covering a river area known as the Sami Chong Valley. And there again, we took up defensive positions, and this time we did a lot of wiring and mine. I don't know whether we did much mine laying, but we certainly did a lot of wiring around the positions. This was about August. September, I suppose, 1951. And then, in November, the Welsh Regiment came and relieved us, and we went back. So in my position, in my case, I didn't have any more, didn't see any more action in Korea, except for going out on patrols and acting as a gunner OP officer, in other words, firing artillery, helping to direct artillery onto Chinese positions. But didn't come across any close combat after that.
Did you have much contact, apart from what you've already said, with Allied forces in the UN army?
None, because I was isolated in my platoon position on top of the hill, and later again in platoon positions on top of hills. So I personally had nothing, and at my level, second lieutenant, had no contact with any other people.
How do you view now, after several decades, your own experience in the Korean War?
From what point of view?
Well, from the point of view of, was it a happy time for you or a miserable time?
Or do you think it was? From a personal point of view, you're not talking about from the grand strategy point of view.
No.
No. Personally, I enjoyed it. I look back on it as a great thrill. I feel guilty that I don't subconsciously feel enough compassion for the poor people who were captured and taken up to the prison camps in North Korea, for the people who were killed. And when I think about it, obviously I feel the compassion that one would feel for this sort of thing. But my own personal feeling was that I was very, very lucky not to have been wounded, not to have been captured, and got away with it in one piece, both mentally and physically. Yeah.
What about the political aspect of the war? Did you feel that you were acting in a worthwhile cause?
Yeah, I mean, we knew that the North Koreans had attacked the South Koreans. We knew that the North Koreans were communists. We knew that communists were a bloody lot, and that they were an evil enemy that had to be combated, fought against. And as a result of that, there was no feeling other than that we were doing the right thing.
Now, I think that you also took part in the Malayan emergency later.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how you came to be involved in that, please?
Yeah. I studied Chinese. I mean, one of the reasons I studied Chinese was because I had been intrigued by going to Japan and Korea and all the mystery of the East. I'm looking across the mountains and wondering what was going on beyond and beyond them. And the whole area fascinated me, so I actually applied to learn Japanese. This is in the army, to take an interpreter's course. And they said, no, sorry, the course is full for next year. Which is, how would you like to do Chinese Mandarin instead? And I said, well, okay, fair enough. Just like that. And so I was put down for a Chinese Mandarin course, much against the likes or the things of my regiment, who didn't want me to go. But, so I did a year at SOAS and then 2 years at Hong Kong University, learning Mandarin Chinese. And then, as a result of that, was posted to Malaya, it was then, as an MIO, or an assistant MIO.
This is an intelligence officer?
Military intelligence officer.
Which year would this have been?
This was in 1957.
Can you tell me what those duties involved, please?
I had a boss who was the MIO, a major. And he worked at police headquarters in Alostar. And I worked at Alostar police station with a Chinese special branch officer. We used to share a room, and he would obviously be running his sources and gaining information from them. And this information was passed to me as necessary if it could be used by the local Malay battalions to to carry out action against the terrorists, Chinese terrorists. There wasn't a great deal of terrorist activity in Kedah, where I was posted, Al-Ostar, being the capital of Kedah. It was a very Malay state, and there weren't an awful lot of Chinese living in it. And therefore, the Chinese terrorists wouldn't have had a great deal of support. But what did happen was that we had a frontier with Thailand, and a lot of the Chinese terrorist camps were built just across the frontier to get away from the strafing by the Malaysian forces. And as a result of that, I used to go up in an Oster, which was a small aircraft, and circle around looking for camps. And I went out on the odd long-range patrol with a group of surrendered enemy personnel, SEPs as they call them, looking for Chinese camps. And because I spoke some Mandarin, I was able to chat to these, because in fact most of the Malay Chinese had a smattering of Mandarin, although their native tongue would have been either Cantonese or something else. I spent about 2 years doing that. One or two of the Chinese terrorists surrendered while we were there, and I had a certain amount to do with interrogating them about their conditions and about the people who were in the various camps and that sort of thing.
What method did you use for the interrogations?
I just talked to them. But the special branch officers who were dealing with them had other methods, and they were pretty rough on them, I think. But my own personal dealings with them were on a much more informal basis, trying to chat to them rather than doing interrogations.
Did that work?
To a certain extent, yes. Because by this stage, these chaps had surrendered, the ones I was talking to, and therefore they'd obviously given up thought of continuing with that. They weren't captive. They hadn't been captured. They surrendered.
What type of things did they come up with?
Oh, all about conditions in the jungle, how they lived, what food they ate, what discipline they had to undergo in the camps, what it was like for women and children, all that sort of thing. You know.
Did they have children in the camps?
Yeah. Babies were born. I remember particularly I had to go one night across to Thailand, where the Thai police had shot about five or six of these people and buried them in shallow graves, and I had to go and undig them, wipe their faces and take photographs of them. And one of them was a woman who was pregnant. Yeah.
Were there people whom you had on record?
Can't remember. The Thai, there were a lot of CTs, as they call them, wandering around in that area in Thailand. And we used to liaise with the Thai police all the time, but you couldn't always tell whether the terrorists were actually...